I'll pick you up. The long message is a stark difference from Henry's usual short and to-the-point texts. I feel my heart like fluttering wings in my chest and close my eyes. I look at the timestamp. When did he send it? 12:05, right as he would be leaving the gym. I shove the image of the blonde out of my mind and feel a rush of love for him. We're not perfect. We may not even be good. Right now. But there's hope there, and I know there's love. I can see it in the way he looks at me. And I flash back to his face, captivated in the flickering candlelight of the Italian restaurant as he detailed the history of the town. Every woman should have a man who looks at her like that, like she's the only one in the room. Was that really only a few days ago? I sent you something. I stand up so quickly that my knee hits the table, and I shove my phone back inside my purse. I hurry through the crowded cafe, jostling elbows and bumping into tables. On the way, I toss the paper cup in the trash. I have my head bent down, and I'm so lost in thought that when I push open the front door, I crash right into Molly McKay. Chapter 18. Hillary? Her voice is shrill with the urgency of a reporter covering a tabloid story, and it takes me a second to make sense of her. She keeps going. I know it's you. Did you follow me here? Just talk to me, please. Why are you doing this? You were my best friend, you know. She leans toward me, her pink lipsticked mouth twisted into a grimace, but her eyes are imploring, clouded with hurt. I have no doubt that she believes that to be true. I tended to follow her around. I was a hanger-on, which was Molly's favorite kind of friend. Probably why I felt such kinship with Mick. I can't just let it go. Why do you keep running away? What happened to you? I have no idea who you are or what you're talking about, but please leave me alone. I start to turn, but she grabs my bare arm, twisting it slightly, and jabs a bright pink manicured finger into my elbow. Right there. You had 22 stitches right there, and I sat in the ER all night with you. You fell off a horse. You liked the ranch hand. What was his name? Oh, yeah, Harlan. He checked up on you later, and we all thought for sure you'd get together, but you didn't. Because he was actually married. But I'm the only one who knows that, because I came back the next day, mind you, from staying at Gunther's, and he was still there at 6 in the morning. You can't pretend you don't know me. Her clear blue eyes never waver. I'm not even sure she blinks. Molly was never a shrinking violet, but I'd never known her to have this kind of verve. As careless as I've been, I can't shrug off Detective Maslow's words. He'd cautioned about ever going back to San Francisco. We caught Jared and the others, the ringleaders. There are still powerful men in hiding. We'll never catch them all. I think of Mick languishing in prison, for he was always an underling. The real terror was Jared, and possibly others, nameless, faceless threats. I think of my ransacked apartment. I think of the driver careening through the intersection, all the things I don't know for sure. Then I think of how Molly, if I relented even for a second, would surely call anyone she kept in touch with. The idea of it, the story alone, was just too juicy. I imagine the news floating out over the airwaves, through the Midwest, back to San Francisco. I imagine the idea of it finding Mick, or worse, Jared. Hillary Lawler, the bitch who put you in jail, is in New York. I'm sorry, but I have no idea who you are. Please leave me alone. I wrench my arm out of her taloned grip. Fine. If you want to be that way, you can pretend all you want. But Gunther and I, we live here now. It's not that big of a city. You took yourself away, like I didn't even matter. Her round, bubbly face hardens at the dismissal. We'll see you around, Hillary. Her voice comes out like a hiss, and on the Hillary, her lip curls. It's the anger that surprises me. I expected confusion, even sadness. She sees it as a rejection and her cheeks model. She gives me a small, slight smile and I inhale quickly. I recognize the look, the covert determination, hollow and self-serving. Our sophomore year, Molly had turned in what she thought was an A paper and had gotten a B. She stared at that paper with this same face, the same dappled cheeks, red and wind-burned, the same hardened black beaded eyes. 3 days later, I heard a rumor. The professor was trading grades for sex. Unsubstantiated rumors. He was suspended for 3 days for investigative purposes. After which he was reinstated. No permanently marred record. No real damage. That was the terrifying part, really. I could never prove it was Molly, but I would have bet our whole apartment on it. When I'd asked her, her lips turned up in the slightest smile. She raised her eyebrows and murmured, "I'm not surprised, really." That's when I knew. I turn and rush away, fighting against the lunchtime crowd, away from that smile. I wipe a sheen of sweat from my forehead and pull my hair back off my neck. She's not going to let this go. Who would? It's a crazy story. I imagine her friendless while Gunther is at his new office all day, out to happy hour at night with co-workers. I picture her bored, roaming her apartment, not unlike the way I roam mine, but without care to distract her, performing internet searches, staking out my building, tracking me down. It could become a hobby to someone. The idea of it squeezes my heart. I duck into a souvenir store covered floor to ceiling with hats and t-shirts, prepaid cell phones and miniature statues of Liberty. "Can I help you?" I spin around and the man stands 2 feet away, crowding me, and I jump back. "No, I'm fine. I just needed the air." The door is open, but the shop is air-conditioned. I pretend to peruse postcards before adjusting my shirt and exiting back out into the street. I take a deep breath and scan the street. No Molly. I head home. I don't look back. There is a box on the dining room table with a single long-stemmed red rose resting on top and a note. "Zoe, I'm sorry about our fight. I've been under stress at work. Please understand, last night was all my fault. There's a party tonight to celebrate our partnership with Nippon. Wear this, be ready at 6, and I'll pick you up. I love you. You are the light of my life." I set the rose down on the table and place the note next to it. Pause. Take a breath. I don't know if this is real, if Reed told Henry he saw me at the gym and this is a placating measure. Was the blonde the real date? The first date? Am I the backup plan? Slowly, I lift the lid off the square box. I unwrap the tissue paper inside and pull out the gown. It's a calf-length, sleek, silk cocktail dress in a deep plum. The neckline plunges more provocative than anything I'd select, and it is trimmed in crystals. I feel my breath catch. It's gorgeous. A hanger lies diagonally in the box, and I slip it under the spaghetti straps and hang it up in the doorway. I scan the kitchen. The glass has been cleaned up, like last night never happened. I suppose I should feel at least unsettled by the fact that my home has been righted in my absence, like a pencil eraser over the sketch of last night's fight. Sometimes it's as though people move around me, thin and wispy like ghosts, quietly arranging my life to Henry's convenience. Penny, Reed.
"I'm sorry to intrude. I didn't know you were going to be home."
I drop the box I'm holding and let out a quick staccato scream. "Penny! Jesus Christ, you scared the living daylights out of me!"
"I'm sorry. I heard you out here. I was cleaning the bedrooms."
She gives a quick flick of her head toward the hall. "Dusting." We don't have many one-on-one encounters like this. She frequently comes and goes conveniently when I'm out of the house. Too frequently to be coincidence, but not in any way that could be questioned. I tend to believe Henry tells her my daily schedule. She fidgets, a duster in her hands, a white button-down shirt tucked into jeans, bare feet pushed into Birkenstocks. Her toenails are painted a surprising red, her feet a healthy tan. She shifts her weight and checks the time on the stove. "Penny, do you like me?" I don't mean to ask the question, but I'm a tad fed up from my day. Tired of sidestepping people and issues and trying to do the right thing for everyone else. I'm tired of roadblocks I can't see, hidden agendas I can't fathom. Her head snaps back and her eyes meet mine.
I don't know you, Mrs. Whittaker.
You can call me Zoe. You call Henry Henry.
I've known Henry since, well, for a long time.
She steps backward like she's going to leave the room. I can feel the impending dismissal. How long? I bend down to pick up the box and turn it over in my hands.
How long what?
How long have you known Henry? I press.
A long time? I've never counted.
She glances nervously over her shoulder and then becomes intensely interested in the duster in her hand, turning it over one way, then the other. Her fingernails match her toenails.
You knew his parents. You knew him as a child.
I did, yes. She backs up toward the doorway, pushing her gray bangs off her brow with her forearm. She has deep-set lines around her mouth, crow's feet at her eyes. I try to remember how old Henry has said she is, but then I realize he hasn't. I'm guessing 65, maybe even 70.
Tell me about him. Tell me anything. He says nothing about his upbringing. Very little about his life before me.
I take a step forward, closing the gap between us. Desperation comes off my skin like a stench. I don't care.
Her voice is a whisper. He was an unusual little boy. So curious. Brilliant, really.
Her voice trails off and she looks away. When she looks back, she squares her shoulders and levels her gaze.
None of this is my place, Mrs. Whittaker.
Penny, I should get back to it. I'll be leaving very soon. She turns and scurries from the room. I actually consider following her, pestering her with questions, forcing her to talk to me. I toss the box back down onto the dining room table, frustrated, and head to my bedroom after grabbing the dress from the doorway. I clip the hanger carefully on the back of the door and lie face up on the bed. It's a beautiful dress, and I wonder where he bought it or when. My eyes feel heavy and I drift to sleep. I dream of college in San Francisco, of Molly McKay in an eggplant evening gown, and Birkenstocks. The car arrives at 5:57 p.m., and I smile to myself. It's so Henry. I smooth the front of my dress. I'm wearing the charm bracelet, the bonsai, the gladiolus, the wings. It's an olive branch. Henry gets out, holding his hand up, palm out, to the driver, indicating that he'll escort me. He stops in front of me, and his eyes are bright, his hair tousled. We don't say anything for a minute. Then both speak at once. He laughs and motions for me to talk.
There's nothing between Cash and me, I blurt out. He pulls me against him, his lips on my hair.
I know. I know that. I'm sorry. Let's just not talk about it. I overreacted.
His hands graze down my spine, his fingertips hot on my skin. He pulls away and gestures toward the car, his hand resting on the small of my back. He touches the bracelet on my wrist as I climb inside and says,
Ah, Zoe.
Have you called the credit card company? I inquire, as though I just thought of it. Innocent.
Yes. They're sending a new one, but these things take time, Zoe.
He pats my arm.
Do you need more money? Is that an issue?
No, I'm fine. I don't even use it all, really. Not all the time. I just wish I didn't have to be so dependent or something. I falter then, not sure of how to proceed. He's studying me.
Whatever you need, Zoe, just ask. I'll do anything, you know that.
He squeezes my hand and kisses my temple at my hairline. We ride in silence, but he grasps my hand, running his thumb along my fingertips. I think of the care benefit, the last time we were in the car like this together, made up and sparkly. I had felt so loved, then, a mere 2.5 weeks ago. Now I can't stop thinking of the girl from the gym, the mental image of his hand cupped around that bright pink backdrop, the pert little swell.
Henry, would you ever be unfaithful?
I stare at our fingers intertwined.
Why would you ask that? No, never.
His answer is quick, definitive. He flashes me a smile.
Peter's wife will be there tonight. Remember her?
I nod. Peter Young, the only person I've ever met that Henry may have called a boss, with his prematurely white hair, straight chiclet teeth, and deeply lined cheeks. I vaguely remember his wife Muriel, small and dainty in her 50s, but with sharp, restless eyes and an infectious laugh. We pull up in front of Heiwa, a trendy Japanese restaurant a mere 4 blocks from Henry's office, skirting the line between Tribeca and Soho, depending on who's asking. Henry leads me inside, giving my hand a quick squeeze. We're led to a private dining room, where 20 people mill around in cocktail dresses and glittering jewelry. I've met most of them. Henry's colleagues are both wary of outsiders and welcoming once you're one of them. I probably have 1 foot in each camp at this point. I spot Muriel Young from across the room, deep in conversation with Reed Pinkman, and I make my way to them. Reed gives me a wide smile and a kiss on each cheek, hovering just a second longer than necessary, his cheek cool and smooth against mine. He's dressed in a navy blue suit with a slim, trendy fit and yellow tie. I look around for his date, and see none.
Zoe, Muriel gives me a quick, cool hug.
It's been a while since I've seen you, dear. How are you?
I give a blithe answer, something utterly unsubstantial. She nods and returns to her conversation with Reed. They're talking about Nippon, the partnership, and my mind wanders. How does Muriel know so much about Peter's business deals? Henry acts as though he's a federal agent.
And when Henry goes there, he should be able to see exactly what Peter's so concerned about.
Right. I can't say that I blame him.
Wait, I interrupt. When Henry goes where? When?
Japan? Tomorrow? Both Muriel and Reed look at me like I've lost my mind.
Oh, right. Sorry, I forgot. I recover quickly and my mind spins. When was he going to tell me? For how long?
I scan the crowd, but I don't see him.
Reed plucks a glass of red wine off a nearby waiter's tray and hands it to me. He then taps my elbow and gives a quick, "I'll be right back" hand motion. I nod, dumbly. Muriel studies me, spinning the stem of her wine glass in her hand.
You didn't know, did you? She cocks her head to the side.
I pause. I'm so accustomed to self-sufficiency that it feels uncomfortable to relent, even with this small an admission.
No, I didn't know. I search the restaurant again and still don't see him.
He's been distracted.
It's okay.
For how long?
A week. She gives me a comforting smile.
Henry is a tough man, Zoe. I've known him for a long time. I never thought he'd recover from Terra.
How so?
Oh, she waves her hand around, her bracelets clattering together. She smiles guiltily and lowered her voice.
He was a mess for a while.
Determined to find out who was driving the car, that sort of thing. He seemed to all but forget about it after he met you.
You're very different.
The wine warms my cheeks.
Did you know her well?
I tilt my head back and take the last swig, the red burning the back of my throat. Muriel gives me a surprised look.
No, I never met her.
Really? Why not?
The back of my mouth goes dry. She leans in, taps my shoulder once.
Terra was agoraphobic, dear. No one ever met her.
Muriel moves on, circulates among the crowd. Eventually I find Henry and hover next to him, but somehow get pushed outside the circle. He doesn't make any gestures to include me, and I border on being ignored. As the night wears on, I grow more and more angry. Why did he invite me? If he's leaving tomorrow, why not enjoy the night together? Why not tell me you're leaving tomorrow? Finally, I grip his elbow and drag him away.
You're going to Japan? You never told me that.
Relax, Zoe.
His tone is dismissive and his eyes narrow.
I was going to tell you tonight.
Muriel Young even knows. Reed Pinkman knows. I look like a fool.
You're being overdramatic. You don't look like anything. Everyone knows how busy I am.
He shakes loose from my grip and holds up his finger to a waiter, indicating another drink. He turns back to me, his eyes dark.
Besides, I thought you'd know already. You're so cozy with Reed these days.
What does that mean? I snap.
Oh, I'm sure you know.
So Reed told Henry I was at the gym. At that moment, Peter Young taps the microphone and asks everyone to sit for dinner. Henry places his hand on the small of my back to guide me. We file into two sides of a straight, long table. It's a larger crowd than I originally thought, about 30 people. Henry sits to my left, and I expect him to pull my chair out, but he turns to the man next to him, ignoring me. I've never seen Henry act so impolitely. He opens doors for women and carries grocery bags for little old ladies on the street. Reed sits on my right. No date tonight? I raise my eyebrows and take a sip of water. Henry's back is inches from my face, an obstinate wall.
Not tonight.
Reed has what is known as boyish charm. Round, pink cheeks, shiny like a newborn's bottom, and long, curling eyelashes, so dark he looks like he's wearing makeup. I've seen women, girls, really, actually swoon from his smile. In this day and age of smartphones, he still keeps a little black book. Reed is one of those people you meet and instantly know you could be friends. Almost everyone feels this way about him. If you shake his hand, your mind spins with all the future memories you could have, all the mischief you could make. You could almost envision him, a grown adult, egging suburban houses and peeling away in his yellow Porsche. People get confused. Have we met before, maybe when we were young? Even now, as he talks, I find myself thinking back to the Cynthia night. The night before Mushaki. The night he helped me, rescued me. I almost laugh at my own dramatizing. Rescue me.
I need to find a wife. I'm almost 40, you know.
He unfolds a napkin and takes a swig from his whiskey glass. No, I thought you were in your late 20s, younger than me. I'm honestly surprised.
I'm an old man, not in spirit, like your Henry. He's an old soul. But I'm not getting younger. Know of any single women who are looking for a husband?
He rests his chin on his palm and faces me, his apple cheeks red from the alcohol. In New York City? I raise my eyebrows. Are you kidding? We must have the highest available women per capita ratio in the country. Wear a sandwich board and stand on the streets. He snorts, a quick huff of air through his nose, and shakes his head.
Find me someone. I need a smart woman, independent. No plastic surgery, no fascination with measuring their thigh gap.
What in the world is a thigh gap? I blink, twice. I'm not sure I want to know. The concerns of half my gender baffle me. In Henry's world, there is no shortage of beautiful, wealthy women who behave like teenagers with limitless bank accounts.
See? Don't you have any friends who are like you, conscious of the world, grateful? That's our problem. No one is fucking grateful anymore.
Look at you, with care.
You're grateful. I bet you were poor growing up, right?
I shift in my chair. At that moment, the sashimi is placed in front of me, beautiful with its brightly colored fish and green vegetables, and a swirl of scarlet miso on the square white plate.
You don't have to answer that. Don't you have friends? I need to find someone like you.
He slurs the like and the you together. At that moment, I realize that Henry has turned around and is paying close attention to our conversation. I meet his gaze and his eyes narrow. He snaps open his napkin in one quick wrist motion and gives a short shake of his head, staring stonily ahead to some point on the far wall. I imagine it's one of Henry's most marketable skills, the stone wall. His face smooths out, perfectly unlined, like chiseled marble. A David statue of my husband and just as cool to the touch. While anger heats most people up, buzzes them and makes them hyper, it has the opposite effect on Henry. He becomes cold and still, his flesh hardens, a corpse taken straight from the morgue refrigerator. Reed blathers next to me, his words skipping and sliding into each other, oblivious to the undercurrent between Henry and me. I lean to my left, nudge Henry with my elbow,
press my fingertips into his quadriceps. He doesn't flinch. The sashimi plates are replaced by dinner plates, large and gleaming with impossibly small portions. Four courses come and go, with Henry smiling at Muriel across the table and Reed chattering to anyone who will listen. At dinner's conclusion, while everyone is drinking dessert wine and sherry, Henry stands, his hand on my elbow, and with a wide apologetic smile, ushers me to the waiting car. In the car, the radio plays classical music at low volume, like Henry always instructs the driver to do. The city street passes silently by, life on mute.
"Say something, please."
I run my fingernail along the window edge, inexplicably damp with condensation.
"I don't want to worry about my wife and other men. I'll say that."
His hands are clasped across his knees, his back rigid. The ball joint of his jaw trembles underneath his skin.
"Is this about Cash or Reed?" I feel my shoulders droop. I'm so tired of this conversation, for no reason. I want to bring up the blonde, but I can't.
It's a big new door, and the room behind it is filled with unknowable variables.
I'm so tired.
"I've never given you any reason to worry.
That's your own doing."
"Zoe."
In the apartment, he says nothing and goes right to his office. The door closes with a heavy click, a hushed echo in the marble hallway. I go to bed knowing, acknowledging for the first time, that we are in trouble. Our life, not what I expect or want, but just the way it is. I realize that tomorrow Henry is leaving for Japan, and I don't know for sure when he's coming home. It occurs to me that maybe he won't be, that our marriage will be over. I spin the charm bracelet around my wrist. Such a unique, creative gift, so out of character for Henry. Just last weekend, he'd been windblown and free, loving, writing poetry, or at least copying poetry. And now, back in the city we call home, he's this other man again, cold, calculating. I feel the bed move underneath me. The blankets pull back and Henry's hand, soft as silk, across my skin. He pulls me against him and my stomach swoops with relief. We've always done this. We've always made up, made love. Nothing has ever been permanent. I was silly to think otherwise. His breath flutters hot in my ear. Before I know it, his hands push up my nightgown and he's on top of me, in me, hard and pressing. His wet gasps against my collarbone come quick, and his hand grips my hip as he grunts, once, twice. It's over in a minute. He pants quietly next to me, his palm smooths my hair off my forehead. In the dark, he stands up, the moonlight reflecting off a sheen of sweat on his skin, and I realize that he is naked, that he came to me for one purpose, and I've served it. He's leaving. He pauses in the doorway, his hand resting on the doorknob, a thin white line of light reflected down his back and leg. His face is turned, and in the half-light, his mouth opens and closes, like he wants to say something. And still, stupidly, my heart catches on the unspoken maybe.
"I'll see you in a week, Zoe."
Chapter 19. The Japan trip has eased some of the pressure. I could not have reasonably told Henry about Caroline if we were A, barely speaking, and B, he was out of the country. Maybe. Who knows? I've decided not to care. The weather has suddenly gotten hot, in the 80s, and today it's all anyone can talk about. Cash's neighbor, the gas station attendant, even Cash himself. I'm meeting my mother for the first time, and all I can think about is whether she will look as much like me as her picture. Will she have the oddball habit of tugging on her ear when she's nervous? Will she bite her thumbnail cuticle? And yet, all I seem to be conversing about is temperature and humidity. They say tomorrow is supposed to be even worse. Even as I hear myself say the words, I can't fathom anything about tomorrow. We take the subway to Queens and walk to his mother's house from the station. His childhood home is a square clapboard smooshed in on the sides like someone had taken it between their palms. The street is lined with similar structures, variations of dinginess. And yet there are flowers in the window boxes. Some are plastic, and well-worn but not tattered American flags hanging from the flagpoles. The kind that stand tall, not the suburban idea of a flagpole that hangs jauntily from the porch post, usually draped with a nylon slip of fabric silk-screened with a smiling cat. Have a marvelous day. The lawns are shorn, bare in some spots, but maintained. His mother's house is empty. She's working, he says, a doctor's office receptionist, and I nod. Cash waves his hand around and mutters something about the neighborhood, how it used to be better. It's the way the middle class always feel around the rich. Apologetic. I'm used to the excuses, the explanations. Truthfully, there's no appropriate response. My money is not mine. We are the same, Cash and I. But to say that denies the privilege that comes with Henry's influence. Instead, I nod and smile. We climb in Cash's late model Honda and head onto I-87 North. The city recedes, and Cash turns on the radio to a top 40 station that plays music I've never heard. I think about how that's possible, that I'm 30 years old and I'm not familiar with contemporary pop music. Lydia would be appalled. Our apartment in Hoboken was never quiet, always bursting with underground punk, hardcore rock, and then sometimes just blasting the latest Pink song. Lydia lived her life in music. Loud, harsh, thrumming beats for Saturdays, and soft jazz for Sunday hangovers. The past year of my life has been outlined in shades of silence. What will you say? Cash turns the volume down on the radio. I have no idea, I shrug. What do you want from her? A mother? He avoids my gaze and taps the steering wheel to a softly thumping beat. No, I'm quick to reply. Maybe. Do you know what it's like to have no one?
You have Henry.
Henry's not around. He's in Japan. I didn't even know he was going.
You were the model couple at the benefit.
The benefit seems like ages ago. We were the model couple then. What was that, 2.5 weeks ago? I remember his hands flitting across my shoulders, fastening the solitaire diamond and then hovering there, reluctant to let go. Everything has gone downhill since the benefit. Molly McKay and Gunther Rowe, Henry's erratic behavior, his violence and mood swings. I can't reconcile this man with the Henry in my memory. But now, removed from Henry and Lydia without the pressure to be one person or the other, the transformation is a bit clearer. The day Henry gently suggested that a nose stud was juvenile.
You're too beautiful for these teenager endeavors. Like you're 13 and trying to piss off your mother.
I took it out because I was 27 and felt immediately silly. It was impulsive anyway, Lydia's influence. My newly short hair, spiked magenta, piercings, attempts to hide but at the same time discover who I would become. With Lydia's help, whether she knew why or not. That night, I popped it out, tucking it under the sapphire necklace he'd given me as a replacement in my jewelry box. Or maybe it was how he'd taken my short, spiky lock of hair between his thumb and forefinger.
This is such a beautiful color. Is it natural? I bet it would be knockout if you let it grow.
Subtle comments here and there about my clothing, how they reflected my spirit, but not my intelligence. And then came the waves of gifts. Cashmere, silk, Versace, and Donna Karan. Thick, draping fabrics. I'd stand in the closet and hold the softest silk to my cheek, like a child's security blanket. Fabrics I didn't even know existed, much less thought I could own. Their colors vibrant and buttery rich. Suddenly, my thrift store plaid skirts and lace tops felt pop bubblegum, cheap. Evelyn used to say that it takes a lifetime to grow into the person you'll become. As I stood in the closet, facing all this glorious elegance, she all but whispered in my ear. Then, gradually, I started wearing Henry's clothes to the flower shop. Then I wore them all the time.
Eventually, I bagged up all my old stuff and gave it to Penny to donate to Goodwill until the last of me was gone. At the time, I didn't feel sad. The parts of me that were old, torn, ratted, and worn were being shucked away in plastic bags. The best parts of my life were yet to come. Hemingway once said that bankruptcy happens gradually and then suddenly. Maybe that's how I became Henry's wife.
"You're not the same person," Lydia scoffed one day as we processed, sliding the stems through our fingers, slicing the bottoms on a bias with our knives, shearing off leaves. "No one is ever the same person. Stagnant people are boring."
I was defensive.
"So, you're saying I'm stagnant? I'm boring?"
She stopped cutting and stared at me, her nostrils flared, an angry horse about to charge.
"No, I'm saying I was bored. With me."
I plunked a gangly zinnia into the nearest stainless water bucket.
"But what you're really saying is that you're bored with us."
Javi stood behind Lydia, his hands resting on his hips.
"Will you come to Paula's show later?"
Javi asked the question with a sarcastic sneer. Paula, Javi's partner, played bass in a punk band in the basement of a bar on Tuesday nights. Except that night, Henry had opera tickets. I raised my eyebrows and opened my mouth, unable to verbalize the rejection.
"Yeah, we didn't think so."
He turned and stomped off. I shrugged in Lydia's direction, like, what's his problem? She twisted her mouth.
"I'm with him here, Zoe. You're too... something for us."
She clicked the knife closed and tossed it, clattering on the stainless steel table. That night, Henry comforted me, assured me that yes, I had changed a bit, but yes, that was okay.
"This is what life is about, Zoe. No one stays the same person forever."
At the time, I snorted through tears. Truly, how many people can one person be? Now, as I sit here in Cash's hot car, the windows down, the warm 80-degree air rushing my cheeks, I can't help but wonder, am I yet again destined to become someone else? It seems impossible that I will arrive home tonight the same Zoe that left the apartment this morning. Cash steers the car off the highway and through an elaborate maze of suburban streets. The sign on the side of the road reads, "Welcome to Danbury." It seems like a nice place to live. Tree-lined cul-de-sacs, backyards with wooden play gyms, winding driveways with glossy SUVs or black BMWs. He makes a sudden left, sliding the Honda behind a navy blue Audi. The clock on the dash reads 10:55.
"We're here."
I stand just behind a palm fiber doormat printed with a glass of red wine and the words, "Welcome. I hope you brought wine," in a jaunty sideways script. The porch holds two rocking chairs, but they're for show, not function, as evidenced by the thick layer of dust and pollen that coat their seats. The house is large and looming, a mix of sunny yellow siding and brick facade. The gardens are sculpted out of arbor vitae and impeccably round topiaries. The door swings open before I ring the bell. Caroline blinks twice at me, as though I were a FedEx man without a package.
"Who's in the car?"
She squints toward the driveway. I had a friend bring me, but he thinks maybe we should talk alone. I shift my weight from one foot to the other and hitch my purse higher on my shoulder. I use the opportunity to study her face. Clear, with only the barest hint of crow's feet at her eyes. It's possible that we look the same age. She opens the door a crack and motions me in. The foyer is grand, 30 feet high with an imposing chandelier. She closes the door quickly and quietly behind me.
"We can sit in here."
She brushes past me and I follow her into a sitting room. The windows are floor to ceiling and the room is flooded with light. The carpet is white, the furniture is white. I squint. She sits to face me and we study each other curiously. She's slighter than I am, almost waif-like, and dressed in jeans and an oversized long-sleeved T-shirt. Her hair is long, just as lustrous and thick as my own, but pulled back into a low ponytail at the nape of her neck. We have the same watery cerulean eyes, the same long but slightly too large nose, the same thin curved upper lip but pouty lower lip.
We have to be brief. I have an appointment.
Her eyes flick to the clock on the far wall and back to me. She picks at imaginary lint on her jeans.
You kept your name. I didn't think Evelyn did that.
She didn't. She named me Hillary. I changed it to Zoe when I moved east. She looks startled.
Why?
It seemed easier, somehow, than taking a third name, I guess. I was escaping my past life. It's a long story. I scan the room, white and glass and sleek black art. It's all so cold.
Zoe, are you in trouble now?
Her expression is so intense I almost want to laugh.
In trouble?
No. I wipe my upper lip delicately with my index finger. I'm married to Henry Whittaker. Do you know him? She shakes her head.
Should I? Is he famous?
In some circles. The conversation is so inane, so civil, like I'm chatting casually with a bank teller. I run out of words then, and the silence seems to take over the room. I'm not sure what to do with my purse. I sit it on my lap, but feel very prim, so I move it to the side and tuck it between me and the white leather arm of the sofa. Inside, I can see my phone has a waiting text message from Cash. It pops on the locked display.
Everything okay? Zoe, what do you want from me?
My head snaps up. Why does everyone keep asking me that? Cash, Lydia, now Caroline?
To know, I guess.
A friendship, at best. A meeting to remember, at worst. I guess I'm having a bit of an identity crisis. I'm surprised by the truth in that, considering I hadn't thought it exactly that way before. She leans forward, places her hand on my arm. We have the same hands, long, thin fingers with short nail beds.
We can't have a relationship, Zoe.
I'm going to tell you a story, not to hurt you or to scare you off, but because it's the truth, and I've come to terms with it. Would you like a glass of water? I nod my head, and she stands up to get it. With her out of the room, I peek into the adjoining room, a stark contrast to the sterility of the one I'm in. It's richly decorated with warm shades of brown, and there are children's toys and books scattered on the floor. One of the couch cushions has been unmoored and lies cockeyed on the floor.
I don't have any lemon.
She bustles in, handing me a glass, and perches on the edge of the white leather chair opposite the couch I'm sitting on. She smooths out her jeans with the palms of her hands. She has the posture of a dancer, straight and confident.
So, the story. Well, when I was 17, I fell in love with a boy named Trout Fishman. Not his real name, of course. His real name was Troy. But everyone called him Trout. Get it? Fishman?
I nodded, in the way one does when they've just learned their father was named Trout Fishman.
Well, he was in a band, played the drums, and had a chin dimple.
There's something about a chin dimple, right? When I don't answer, she gives a little cough and continues.
We met the usual way and dated.
I loved him.
Probably more than he loved me, but I think that's typical in high school.
He was a good kid. Stayed out of trouble. Until he got his girlfriend knocked up. She pauses, and for a split second, it occurs to me that he's out there somewhere. Another link, another tether, someone else to find.
There was the usual drama at first. Our parents cried, the kids at school whispered. But I hadn't been the first girl to get in trouble, and Lord knows I wouldn't be the last. Our parents talked of helping us, so we could finish high school. Maybe even go to community college.
Trout took electrician classes at the Votech school.
We were excited, but not always. One night, we fought. I was riddled with insecurity, thought I was holding him back. I was a burden. I was 7 months pregnant and hormonal.
He left, slamming the door behind him and went to blow off steam with his friends. He ended up at some druggie's house, a guy we didn't talk to in school because he was going nowhere. But then again, I was a teen pregnancy statistic, so who was I to judge? This guy gave him a handful of Quaaludes and told him it would erase all his cares. To a 17-year-old kid staring at fatherhood and dealing with a hormonal girlfriend with no job, he couldn't have said anything more perfect. Trout took the whole handful at once. They laughed, thought he'd be stumbling around, bumping into walls. They weren't really known to kill you back then. It was the 80s. But Trout had a weak heart, as it turned out. He just couldn't handle a street drug. He had a heart attack that night, fell into a coma, and died a week later. And just like that, the idea of a father slips away. The shock must have registered on my face because she pauses to drink a sip of water, licks her dry lips, and gazes off into a corner. Off in the distance, in the kitchen, I assume, a phone rings. Once, twice, and then goes to voicemail. She doesn't even acknowledge it. When she finally continues, her voice is flat. I was heartbroken. Naturally, I suppose, the way a pregnant teenage girl would be. My parents were at a loss with what to do with me. I dropped out of school, wouldn't leave my room. Labor was a nightmare. I was just so angry. I've never known such anger, even now. Can you understand that? I nod, although I can't. I've never been pregnant, never born a child. The love a mother must feel for a child is ephemeral to me, out of reach, an idea unattached to any real rooted emotion. After I had you, I got involved with drugs then myself. Which admittedly makes no sense. I was a different person. You said you were running from your life. That's what I was doing. I didn't change my name, but I ran away, bobbed around the country, didn't hold the job, got arrested a bunch of times, was addicted to heroin, went to rehab, found God like I'm supposed to. Met Ronald one day at church. Ronald? Oh, my husband. He's at work, an accountant. We have a son, Benjamin. He's at Ronald's mother's house right now. I didn't want him here for this. She waves her hand between us like this is something horrid. I'm her first failed attempt at motherhood. The anger slices under my ribcage, sharp and unexpected. Ronald doesn't know everything about my past. He knows I was in rehab, but he doesn't know how bad it was, how I was homeless, how I was destitute. He doesn't know I've already been a mother. Can you see? She keeps asking me to understand and to see. Perhaps I should be more lenient, less judgmental, comfort her. But I can't. I should be tolerant. Our stories are shockingly parallel. I imagine nodding sympathetically, maybe touching her arm. I understand, with a soft cluck of my tongue. And maybe that would be the key. She'd invite me back, we'd have coffee, I'd learn that after all these years all she needed was an outlet, and now here I am. Conveniently. I'll become somewhat of an accidental friend, a hidden secret, almost arcane. The vision is romantic, like a love affair. Her liquid blue eyes implore mine, mirror images of each other, to simply go away. She rambles on as if talking to herself. I've already done this once and that was enough. I'm done, okay? There are only so many times a person can explain herself. I interrupt her. So who was Evelyn, then, to you? Evelyn? Oh, she was my mother's cousin. They spoke once in a while before you were born, but I was such a wreck afterward my mother didn't know what to do. She heard Evelyn and her husband, God, I can't even remember his name, Tom, was it? She taps her fingernail on the edge of the table, thinking. I don't fill in his name, partially because I don't want to divert the conversation. His name was Tim, a tall, shadowy man I barely remember. Dark hair, Old Spice. She shakes her head. Well, whatever. My mother had heard they wanted to adopt. I don't know how or under what context. One of the bad nights, right before I ran away, mother called her, begged her. Evelyn didn't want to at first. She said it could get messy with family. She wanted a baby to love all her own, not to lose later, you understand. I guess that had happened before, and adoption fell through. We had to promise to never seek you out, that Evelyn would tell you on her own when she felt the time was right. I appreciate this simple kindness. For all her chilly demeanor, she doesn't have to give it to me, the reassurance that Evelyn's hesitancy came from love, not rejection. She is, above all else, self-aware then. She sits up straight, pulls her arms against her midsection, protective. How is she, your mother? She's dead. My voice is flat and I close my eyes. You didn't know? Her face freezes, her eyes go wide. No, well, the whole family sort of fell apart later. After my mom died, there was talk of a reunion at one point. The genealogy website. Growing up, I remember asking Evelyn about family. Other people had cousins, big 4th of July barbecues and vacations, dramatic fights and people to call when your car broke down or you needed to borrow $100. This is what I saw on television. At the time, she'd touched her eyebrow, shook her head. We have only each other, bud. I wonder now, had she wanted it that way? To protect me? Or to keep me? Caroline leaned forward, her breath hot on my cheek, her eyes studying my face, so close we could touch. But we didn't. Listen, she said. No one wanted to hurt either of you. It all happened so fast, and I was barely functioning. But you have to understand, Mother thought if she knew, she'd back out. She didn't know there were two. That she wouldn't want you both. I knew it wasn't the best thing to do, but you have to understand. My heart picks up speed. Two? Both? Her hand flies to her mouth, and between those long, delicate fingers I hear, I thought you knew. I thought that was how you found me. She knows about you. I just assumed she sent you. Who? Who sent me? Who is she? My mouth keeps asking questions my brain already knows the answers to. I had twins, Zoe. You have a sister. Chapter 20. I don't understand, I say. You've met her? Where is she? I whip my head around like she's going to magically appear in the living room. My hands are shaking and a pulse throbs in my neck. I think she lives in Brooklyn with her parents. She was here, oh, maybe 3 or 4 years ago? She knows about you. I told her, but she had already known. Her adoptive parents. Caroline splays her hands outward and lets me fill in the missing information. Evelyn didn't know everything. Why? She takes a deep breath and stands up. Her name is Joan, but hold on, I'll get you all her information. She scuttles out of the room on the balls of her feet, nervous. She's had control of the conversation up to this point, and now she's anxious, impatient. She returns not more than a minute later, holding an index card. She pauses in front of me, running her fingernail over the words before she hands it over. We didn't keep in touch. It's all the information I have. Her eyes are huge against her pale face. She's beautiful, my mother. I look like her, but in small ways. In person, our differences are obvious. I'm a cartoonish version of her. I'm drawn with a magic marker, deep, confident lines. She's sketched with an artist's touch, feathery strokes and skittish shadows. She's like me, nervous. I take medication. Do you? Is that genetic? It was interesting. Her mannerisms are so much like mine. You? Not as much. She studies me and I duck my head, studying the index card, the words sliding around as my vision blurs. My sister's name and address in Brooklyn are scribbled with disjointed handwriting, slanting one way, then the other. Joan Boscio. I look up at Caroline questioningly. You can keep that. I copied it. She looks over at the chair, like she can't decide if she should sit or if the conversation is over, and she ends up half hovering over me, stooped and nervous like a Bryant Park pigeon.
If Evelyn had known, she would have taken us both, I say confidently. Why didn't she know? Evelyn was the most maternal person I'd ever met. Her need to nurture was a constant presence in my childhood. Every twisted ankle tended to as though she were a wartime nurse. Every cut and scrape thoroughly scoured with alcohol. Despite being woefully unprepared and hopelessly scattered, she'd make up for her lack of preparedness in fret time alone. Her concern was never limited to me. Any lone wolf, lost child, homeless puppy. She was a natural adopter of all misplaced things. When I was 16, I broke my wrist, just a hairline fracture. I'd been helping her clean the faculty office buildings at Berkeley after school, one of her many patchwork jobs. We'd take the train down from Richmond to the UC campus, moving in and out of the administration building, quiet as mice. I'd stood on a chair, trying to dust a light fixture hanging from a conference room ceiling. When I fell, she screamed louder than I did. In the emergency room, I alternated between reading and daydreaming, trying to distract myself from the pain. Evelyn was quiet, mostly concerned with the bill, her mind running constant stream of copays and deductibles against account balances and paychecks. She processed numbers like a ticker tape. A young girl, about my age, paced along the far wall. Hours later, with my arm set and casted in a thick white plaster, I emerged through the big double doors back into the lobby, and the girl was still there. She sat on the floor, her back pushed up against the wall, mascara streaks down her face. Evelyn squared her jaw, marched right over to her, and after a short whispered conversation, brought the girl over. "This is Rachel, and she's coming home with us for dinner." She said it so matter-of-factly, neither Rachel nor I dared argue, despite the fact Evelyn and I had eaten hot dogs and baked beans 3 nights running. Eat what? I didn't have the gall to ask. We ate whatever meat Evelyn could find, white and mysterious in the freezer, chopped up with canned vegetables, and then she drove Rachel home. When she returned, her eyes were red-rimmed from crying, but she never explained why. When I pressed her, she just hugged me and called us lucky. This, mystery meat surprise and all, we're lucky. The idea that Evelyn could know about another baby and reject her? Impossible. She had no idea there were two babies. She wouldn't have taken you. She couldn't afford both of you. There was no way. If she would have known, she would have backed out. She runs her palm along her forehead as though massaging a headache. It sounds awful now, I know. At the time, it was just survival. The whole thing was a mess, but I was in too bad a place to care. Mother found someone else interested in adoption, and she took your sister. It was all done privately, through an agency. She finally sits on the edge of the chair, crossing her legs, all knobby knees and pencil calves. Mother kept tabs on both of you for a long time. Then Joan came to see me. The implication is obvious. Caroline did not keep tabs on us. So everyone knew I had a sister but Evelyn and me? She knows, you knew, we're the only ones who didn't know. I set my water down on the glass-top end table with force. Well, you can't understand unless you're in the situation. Then, later I just think Joan wanted to find you in her own time. Or maybe she tried and couldn't? Yes, that made sense. Hilary Lawler became Zoe Swanson, then Whittaker. An amateur sleuth might lose that link. But you didn't try? To help her, I mean? She didn't ask. I gave her what I knew, which wasn't much. She presses the pad of her thumb along the arm of the chair, avoiding my gaze. I say nothing. Zoe, there's something you should know. She reaches around me, parting the window curtain, and for a second I can smell her shampoo, her shower soap. She's so close I could lean over and kiss her cheek. I shouldn't tell you this, but someone called me. Her voice is low. I think it was a man. It was hard to tell, but someone is watching me, or maybe you. She touched me then, her hand cold on my shoulder. He threatened me. He said to leave you alone.
Who was it? Who called you?
I'm so confused.
She holds her hands out, palms up, and shakes her head. I don't know.
I have a child. He's 6. I'm 46. He wasn't supposed to be able to be born. I tried for years to no avail and honestly believed I was being punished for what I did. To you, to your sister, for my abandonment, my selfishness.